This week, we are presenting the February installment of our full bio series, where we take one of those big, deeply researched biographies and discuss it with its author over the course of a week. We are talking about the 2018 Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. Its author, David Blight, used primary source material, Douglass's own words, plus new information drawn from private collections to produce an 829-page book that took a decade to write. And the book, by the way, just came out in paperback. Today, we pick up Frederick Douglass's story as he is becoming a sought-after and well-known anti-slavery speaker. His words and delivery were bold and unusual for their personal nature. To get a sense of his work, here is James Earl Jones reading a section of one of Douglass's most famous speeches, one he gave on July 5, 1852, called What to the Slave is Fourth of July.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham. Your boasted liberty, an unholy license. Your national greatness, swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless. Your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence. Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings, with all your religious parade and solemnity, are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. There's not a nation of the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour.
As you can imagine, Douglass was not beloved by all. He was chased. He was bloodied. His home was attacked. And once, right here in New York City in Battery Park, he was surrounded by a mob for having the impudence to walk with two white women he considered friends. But this didn't deter him from traveling across the country and across the Atlantic to England and Ireland to speak out against the United States' original sin. Here's my conversation with David Blight. What void did Frederick Douglass fill with his specific skills and his type of oratory and writings that wasn't, what void was he filling in the anti-slavery movement?
Well, if it's a void he's filling, it is, he's not the first, but he certainly became the most prominent former slave, Black American, to stand up on the platforms out in park-like settings, in pulpits of churches, in town halls and city halls. He became the witness, the former slave who could tell his story of enslavement, who could tell about the potential psychological destruction of the slave system. The void he filled was that role of being the witness of the actual experience. Now, I would add to that, though, he was much more than just the Black spokesman. He wanted to be much more than simply the exhibit up on the stage, the exhibition up on the stage. Douglass, early on, became an astute analyst. An analyst of the meaning of slavery, an analyst of the meaning of racism, an analyst of the threat of slavery itself to the existence of the United States, and he became, really, very quickly, a master storyteller. He was brilliant at unfolding narratives verbally, through oratory. He is simply a master storyteller. And we see that very early. I mean, the first speech for which we have a text comes from 1842. Then we get a few more text of speeches in the next year or so. And then eventually, by the mid-1840s and into the late 1840s, we have lots of text of the speeches Douglas delivered, his own texts, and then sometimes those texts as recorded by journalists. This was now an orator who could do what the Columbian orator had taught him to do, and that is use your full body, use the fullness of your voice, start low, but work toward crescendos. But above all, he was the orator who could take you somewhere. He was the orator who could tell you a story that you are suddenly embodying, and you're coming along on a journey somewhere, and ultimately that journey is taking you to some deep moral message that probably will make you hurt. And last point about that, his first few years out on the circuit in particular, 1841, 42, 43, 44, his most popular lecture, his most popular subject was what became known as the Slaveholder's Sermon. This is where Douglas would get up and he'd start reading some of those passages in the Bible that are pro-slavery. You know, slaves, be loyal to your masters, and so on and so on and so on. He'd read some of those passages, and then he'd read something else from the gospel that would be anti-slavery. But mostly, he would start mimicking a pro-slavery preacher in the South. He'd prance around the stage. He'd go into his Southern accents. And it was so popular when he would do these that it got to the point out on the circuit that the way abolitionists ran their gatherings is they would have four or five speakers. They'd have a resolution. Each speaker was supposed to speak to or against the resolution. But often they'd be doing their resolutions, and somebody in the audience would just shout out, I have a number of these examples, they'd say, hey, Fred, do the sermon. And he'd say,
his greatest hits, if you will.
Yeah, do your greatest. Sing us the old song, you know. And he'd just break into his slaveholder's sermon, and he'd have them laughing and weeping. And, of course, the whole point of that slaveholder's sermon was to just dig the irony out of the hypocrisy of pro-slavery preachers. And this speech would be a staple for him whenever he needed it for years to follow. In fact, religious hypocrisy about slavery became, at least in his early life, Douglas's absolute favorite subject.
As people wrote about him, they always seemed to include his physical description. Mm-hmm. And they always commented on him being of mixed race and the way he looked. First of all, I would love to know your thoughts on why that is. And did he mind being objectified like that, or did he find a way to use it?
Oh, it's mostly that he found a way to use it. I think he did mind at times, but we're talking here in the middle of the 19th century. And race consciousness was so complete and so, you know, ubiquitous, there was no way to avoid it. So, yes, Douglas was light-skinned, relatively light-skinned, but clearly a black person. There was never any question about him passing. But he made it perfectly well-known and open that his father was white and might have even been his master. He told that story over and over and over, and he would play off it. He would joke off it at times, you know. I said, well, I can do this, you know, and that's probably because of my white father. But I can do that, and that's probably because of my black mother. But, you know, we're talking the 19th century here. We're talking the heyday of racial science. And look, it's still alive today. People wonder if somebody who's of mixed race, well, they're more intelligent because they got one white parent or something. That's still embedded in people. It's still deep down. No matter how much we learn about how race is a social construction and how much the biology of race is essentially a fiction, in the 19th century, they didn't know that yet. So Douglas would sometimes use it to his advantage. He was very good at converting, shall we say, the awkward truths into humor. into ways of connecting with his audiences. And again, it took time. He did not walk out of slavery a fully formed orator by any means. He had to practice it over and over and over. And he learned a lot from the people around him. He learned a lot from Garrison, for example, about how to use the Bible in his rhetoric. And God, did he ever. That's a huge part of Douglass's oratory, is particularly his uses of the Hebrew prophets, the Old Testament prophets. But what Douglass also learned along the way is how to connect with audiences, what they cared about, what stories would grab them, how he could have them in his hands. And we're talking about speeches he would sometimes deliver for an hour, even 2 hours. Today, you couldn't get away with that. Nobody had the attention span. But he became early on a master in this golden age of oratory. You got to remember, oratory in the middle of the 19th century was the only game in town. It was the only entertainment in town. And abolitionists, especially in these early years, were hugely controversial. They were not loved in most towns. In fact, they courted the scorn of their audiences. It was considered a success for some of these traveling troops of abolitionists, if they had a few things thrown at them. That meant the audience had been worked up, they had been troubled, they had reached somebody. They just hoped that what was thrown at them wouldn't kill them.
And they also didn't always agree with one another. There were different philosophies in the anti-slavery movement. Where was Frederick Douglass early in his career?
Well, early on, he's a thoroughgoing Garrisonian, which simply means a follower of William Lloyd Garrison. That meant he was, in those first 5, 6, 7 years of his speaking career, a moral suasionist. That is, the effort was to change the hearts and minds of people, and not so much to change the law or to change the political system. Garrison even taught that political parties were to be avoided. They were dirty. They were complicitous with slavery. Garrison also argued for a kind of radical anarchism of a kind. He called it disunionism. He said what Northern abolitionists really should do is pull out from the Union, disunify with the South, not be complicitous with slavery. That one was hard to follow. Garrison was also a pacifist. Strict pacifists. They called it non-resistance. And Garrison advocated not voting. Now, some of these were easier for Frederick Douglass and some other black abolitionists to follow because they had such respect for Garrison, but some of them were not. Mm-hmm. Douglass, though, is a thoroughgoing Garrisonian until he writes that first narrative, 1845. He goes off to England. Between 1845, fall 1845, and the spring of 1847, and it was during that 19-month or so tour of Ireland, Scotland, and England where Douglass just flowered. He encountered situations with far less racism than he encountered in America, and sometimes no racism at all. He was embraced by the Irish abolitionists. The Scots loved him. And all over Britain, he made permanent friends in the British reform circles and in the British anti-slavery movement. A group of British abolitionists led by two sisters in Newcastle raised the money to purchase his freedom. So Douglass came back from England in 47, a much more independent young man. And now he's 29 years old. And he's beginning to ideologically and even personally break with Garrison. Garrison had been, though, a genuine mentor, almost like a father figure, at least an older brother figure. And Douglass adored Garrison to some extent. But they will have a big, terrible ideological falling out, of course.
You write of that relationship between William Lloyd Garrison and Douglass. In mythic terms, it was important and turbulent. When did the turbulence come in?
The turbulence began after 1847 and then into 48 and 49 because Douglas wants to be independent. He moved from Massachusetts. Lynn, Massachusetts is where they'd been living. He moved out to Rochester, New York, in western New York, a city now at the end of the Erie Canal, but a city that was known to be a kind of safe haven for abolitionists. And Garrison and his Garrisonians did not want Douglas to do this. He wanted to create his own independent newspaper. He wanted to go on his own. The Garrisonians wanted Douglas to stay within the fold because he was their star. Douglas and Garrison did their final lecture tour together in 1848. They traveled from Pennsylvania all out through Ohio, and they were supposed to do the swing right back into the state of New York. They were operating with what was known as the Oberlin tent. This was a huge tent that had been created in Oberlin, Ohio, which was an anti-slavery town with an anti-slavery college. They claimed they could get at least 2,000 people into this tent. They would put that baby up out in a farmer's field or on the edge of some village or town. They'd take it down, put it in the wagon, and take it to the next town. But at one point, Garrison began to lose his voice, and he got deathly sick. And Garrison went on up to Cleveland and was very, very ill with pneumonia and who knows what else, and nearly died. Douglas stayed on the circuit. But that was the last time they ever really collaborated on anything, because it was right after that Douglas let Garrison know he was moving lock, stock, and barrel to Rochester, New York, and going to create his own newspaper. The real breakup, though, comes in about 1850-51, when Garrison and the Garrisonians condemned Douglas, and Douglas made a full ideological shift to the politics of abolitionism, to advocating the right to vote, and even advocating, in certain circumstances, the uses of violence against slavery. And also there was, as you know from reading the book, that there was a scandal involved. And the scandal involved a white woman, mm-hmm. an English woman named Julia Griffiths, whom Douglas had met in England. And Julia came to America in 1849, came out to Rochester, lived in the Douglas home for the following 3 years, and then after that for three more years just up the road. And she became Douglas's assistant editor. She became his chief fundraiser. She was an extremely close friend and confidant. She was his right-hand person in running his newspaper and his anti-slavery operation. The Garrisonians, though, so resented Douglas by 51 that the Garrison himself just announced that Douglas was having an affair, a sexual affair, with Julia in his own home under the eyes of his children and his wife. Now, this was vehemently denied, of course, by Douglas and by Julia and by Anna, his wife. But it was the last straw, and Douglas and Garrison would never again be good friends. In fact, they wouldn't even appear in the same platform or the same room together again for another 10 years. Now, everyone's wondering, of course, is that story true? I doubt it. I doubt there was a sexual affair between Douglas and Julia Griffiths. We don't know for sure. What we do know is it was an extremely close friendship and an extraordinarily important friendship. Julia and her sister bought the mortgage on Douglas's house so he wouldn't lose the house. She raised a lot of money to keep his newspaper alive from a well-to-do abolitionist in upstate New York. She was indeed an assistant editor. She kept that newspaper going at times when Douglas himself was either on the road or at times actually quite ill himself. In fact, I point out in the book that in 1851, for a period of time, Douglas, by all appearances, had a nervous breakdown. I think it's one of the true crucial turning points in his life. Here was the so-called self-made man who could barely make ends meet, who could barely put food on a table for his now family of five children. And he just came apart. And he was, you know, trying to end slavery in the United States. And there was no reason to believe you were ever going to be able to do that. And Julia sort of held the ship together at the printing office. And she also, from her letters, we know, would stay up late nights reading the Psalms with Douglas, sometimes singing favorite hymns, and sometimes also reciting favorite poems by Robert Burns. Douglas was a huge fan of Robert Burns. And also, I should say, Julia Griffiths was the original source of Douglas's now growing library. She helped purchase some of their first collections that Douglas owned. He would end up with a huge library later in life. Julia would be gone, though, by 1855. She moved back to England, where she married a doctor named Crofts. But Douglas and Julia Griffiths stayed in correspondence the rest of their lives. And I should say that what this relationship meant to Douglas, among other things, is that he had a genuine intellectual comrade, whereas his wife Anna, though extremely important in his life and obviously the lives of the five children, remained a non-reader, non-writer all of her life.
That was my conversation with David Blight about his biography, Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, for our monthly series, Full Bio. Tomorrow, we will continue the conversation about his long and difficult marriage to his first wife, Anna, his four surviving children, and his turbulent relationship with German feminist and abolitionist, Ottilia Ossing.